Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. This podcast has been on such a roll lately, and I've been honored today to interview some of the most inspiring people that I have talked to in probably my whole life. Thinking really about my journey personally with this disease and how much I want to see change and how I want to see drug development and approval happen. And these folks literally have done everything in their power to see it forward. This episode today is a conversation in advocacy work, and it's a conversation in celebration. There's so much to talk about as we welcome three of the biggest advocates for the FDA approval, Madison, Jordan, and Walker. They all rolled up their sleeves and they got the job done. So first, welcome. And second, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I am so impressed with each of you. So I think before we talk about all of the work that was done in 2025, I think we should give you each a time to introduce yourself, how you got into this space, your family, you know, who is affected, and what made you feel so passionate about getting into this grassroots group. Walker, do you want to start us off?
So I lived with the symptoms of Barr syndrome for 27 years. And when I got the call or the email to have an opportunity to be a part of a research project that could potentially, you know, change my life forever, I said absolutely. You know, there was no reason for me not to say yes to this. And, you know, it all started, and I don't know how much you guys know about, you know, Barr syndrome, but it really affects your energy, your strength, and your quality of life. And before I started a drug, I had such little energy. I barely had enough to get through the day. And in terms of my strength, I was so weak. For every quarter of a mile, I had to stop and rest two or three times. And because of those things, you know, my quality of life suffered severely. And it was like a shadow or a wall. You couldn't go over it. You couldn't go through it. You couldn't go around it. It was with you everywhere you went. And, you know, there was really nothing you could do about it. But in August of 2017, I started the drug, and, you know, my world started to change slowly. And it all started with my energy improving. And then once I had enough energy, I was able to walk further. My strength, you know, improved. And then because of that, my quality of life, you know, improved. And it was just this snowball effect that would just, you know, change my life forever. And I've been on the drug now for 8.5 years. And, you know, I'm doing things now and have been doing things now that I was only able to dream about before for 27 years. And, you know, as I tell people, I'm living the life, or like I said, I'm living the life I can only dream about. But because of this drug, if someone were to ask me today if I had the symptoms of Barr syndrome, I would say, no, I had the symptoms of Barr syndrome. That's how I end in my AdCon speech. That's how I end, you know, sum up this whole experience is, you know, if someone were to ask me today if I had the symptoms of Barr syndrome, I would say, no, I had, because the question of, you know, well, do I have enough energy to do this? Do I have enough strength to do that? Am I just able to do whatever has not been a question or a concern for many, many years? I mean, like I said, I've been on it for, you know, 8.5 years nearly, and it's wild. I am living the dream that I hope all people with Barr syndrome and other mitochondrial disorders can live, because I truly am doing things I could only dream about before.
I'm so happy for you, Walker. Was it a very quick change in how you felt, or was it gradual?
Yeah, no, it's very gradual.
Okay.
So basically I was part of the original trial. I think I forgot to say that. So there was 12 of us that enrolled in this trial, and it was conducted at Hopkins in Baltimore. But it was a placebo, double-blind placebo-controlled crossover study is what they call it. So basically, for half of the study, for 12 weeks, I was on drug, and then they took me off for 4 weeks for a washout period, and then they crossed me over. So whatever I was, and for everybody else too, whatever they were on the first half, they were not on the second half. So the reason why they did that is, you know, as you all probably know, you know, Barr syndrome was very rare. So that way they didn't have to find 24 patients. They only had to find 12 and use us as two people essentially. So, and then after that, so that was the blind portion. Then we immediately enrolled in the open label extension, and that lasted 2 years, about 104 weeks. And then we filed for the first NDA, new drug application. And then while that was under review, they immediately enrolled us into the compassionate use program. And I've been on that ever since, up until last month when I was switched over to a prescription, and I'm on it as a prescription.
Oh, what a relief. Now. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Do you wake
yeah.
up some days yeah. and just say to yourself, like,
yes,
this happened.
Is this real?
Yeah.
Yeah. I honestly, it's like I'm still waiting for something to happen.
Hmm. Yeah, for the shoe to drop. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I for this dream to you know, stop, you know, and I thought, you know, during the transition to getting it covered by insurance, they were going to give us a lot of trouble, you know, and that was going to take forever. And, you know, it really didn't. I mean, and I think for me, a lot of that was because I've been on it so long, and, you know, they had all the data and the research, and that's one thing that the doctor had to do is submit all that before they said yes, but they didn't really put up a fight. So, and that's what I'm worried about for them, you know, the kids that it was approved for, and it was approved for boys diagnosed with Barr syndrome for 12 years and up, or like 66 pounds, I guess it really is. And what I'm concerned for them is because they haven't been on it, obviously we don't have a lot of data, they're going to put up that fight of, well, we don't, you know if it's really going to work for you in particular, you know. But I know there's been a few boys already that have been put on it. They contacted me with, you know, some questions or whatever, and I've heard through social media and whatever that many people are about to start it and are in the process and whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I still kind of pinch myself sometimes.
Well, I'm so happy. I just hope it's semi-smooth sailing moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it will. I mean, I think for me personally, I think I'm okay. But, you know, we still got a lot of work to do for the babies, you know, getting all these other kids on it, older adults, but older boys. But yeah, it's been a journey.
Thank you, Walker. Madison, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us about you and your family?
My son Gilbert, who is a year now, has Barth syndrome. We did not know it when he was born, but we did have a little bit of an inkling that there might have been something like in our family, because I had an older brother who passed away of heart failure before he turned a year. And so when I was pregnant with Gilbert, my doctor suggested I do fetal echocardiograms to see if there was anything going on with his heart. They didn't find anything that was super concerning, so they felt like they could just check him again after he was born. He was born on December 24th of 2024, and within 24 hours, we were admitted to the NICU at our hospital because He was having low temperatures and he was hypoglycemic. So he had really low blood sugar. We were at our local NICU at the hospital he was born at for 3 days while they tried to figure out what was going on and try to stabilize him. And that's when we did the repeat echo and they saw that he was in heart failure. So then we were airlifted over to our local children's hospital. And then it was there that we got his diagnosis when he was a little over 2 weeks old. And luckily, the cardiologist that we have, Dr. Chatfield, has been involved with the Barth syndrome community and knew about elmepritide and had recently testified at the FDA AdCom. So she was, you know, having her as our cardiologist was just to us, like, we felt like we were the luckiest people in the world because we were able to have the conversation around diagnosis, which was, you know, your son has this really rare condition. It's, you know, has a really high mortality rate for infants and children. But what I can tell you is that we do have a potential treatment option for him. And at the time, it was early January, and the approval was we were supposed to find out if it was at the end of January or not. And I do remember saying to her, like, well, what if it doesn't get approved? Is there a way for us to get started on this medication now? And she was like, yep. So we'd started through compassionate use, through like emergency use because his heart failure was so bad. He started it January 21st. So we're coming up on a year of him being on it. And then we were discharged from the hospital like 2 months after he started elmepritide. So he's been on ever since. And we've since learned that my brother Ben also had Barth syndrome, and that was the reason for his passing, and that's why he had heart failure. So Gilbert has kind of been the reason we've figured out some missing pieces in our family as to, you know, why something like that happened. And then in terms of like our journey into advocacy, we got started as soon as we found out that the elmepritide was denied. We basically were like, he's done so well on this. Like, we can't not fight this, because to us, it was like either we fight this or he's going to die because his heart failure was so bad in the beginning. And he was on, you know, he was on heart failure medications. He was on milrinone. He had a 24/7 IV of milrinone, and Tide really was what made the difference. So we knew we were going to fight it with everything we had because we knew it just wasn't an option for us to not have him on. So yeah.
He's so lucky to have such a compassionate mom and one that went out and figured out how to make change happen, right?
Yeah, well, we weren't alone. I mean, I was talking with Kate McCurdy, who's one of the moms who founded the Barth Syndrome Foundation. I texted her and Shelly the other day because it was like the year since we've gotten Gilbert's diagnosis. And I just texted her to thank her because we wouldn't be where we are today without them. And Gilbert and I wouldn't be here today without Walker and Jordan. Like, it's just this compounding effect of everybody who's come before you and everyone who will come after you. Like, it was really just not even an option to get involved. It was like, we have to do this because the reason we're even in this position is because of the hard work and the years that everybody before us has put into it, you know? So yeah, I think everybody's kind of has a similar outlook, and that's probably why as a team, you know, the Barth syndrome community and the larger mito community of people who are also on elmepritide without Barth through expanded use, that's why everyone came together and fought so hard, because everybody has been doing it for years.
Well, you said that very well, and it's inspiring to hear that even though the condition is very rare and it's a small group of people in comparison to other conditions, and that you can come together and have a very strong voice. Thanks for sharing your story, Madison. We'll hear back from you a little bit more.
I have a question for Madison, because I'm just curious, and I think it'd be a good part of like Gilbert's story. How long was he on elmepritide before you were released from the hospital and his heart returned to normal function?
So we were released almost 2 months after he started, like a little under. So like he started it January 21st. We went home March 18th. His heart function has improved. It hasn't returned to normal yet, though. So, but what's crazy is, like, when you look at him, you don't, like, he doesn't look like a kid with a failing heart. You know, his ejection fraction definitely has improved to the point that, like, he can, you know, he's okay and he's out in the wild at Helms. But yeah, so I mean, I think that's kind of what's interesting about Elmebrutide is, like, it can, everybody's, like, Bart syndrome is so different across whoever has it. So, like, it doesn't look the same in any two kids. But for him, like, the biggest thing I think for him was his energy and his ability to eat. He had, when he was first hospitalized, like, he could barely eat. And he had to get an NG tube within a couple of weeks because he just wasn't gaining weight. He wasn't even on the growth curve. And as soon as he was on Elmebrutide, like, we as parents noticed it after, like, about a week. We were like, he's, like, actually able to eat and, like, bottle feed. And so we did the NG tube as, like, to make up the difference of what he was supposed to be eating. But then, like, he got that NG tube out after a month of being on Elmebrutide. And, like, energy-wise, I mean, like, all he does is just, like, cruise. Like, he's, like, unstoppable. He just goes around and, like, he's trying to walk.
Jordan, let's give you time to introduce you and your family to all of us and to the listeners.
We have a really long line, like, family history of Barth syndrome. I had a little brother, Jonathan. He passed away in 2004, undiagnosed. And it wasn't until, like, 2021 where we slowly had, like, researched the Barth Syndrome Foundation and, like, looked up what Barth Syndrome was. And we decided to reach out to the Barth Syndrome Foundation, and they offered free genetic testing to me and my sister for being carriers of Barth Syndrome. And that was in 2021. I tested positive as a carrier, unfortunately. My sister tested negative. So I knew I was a carrier. And then that kind of, like, trickled to my brother's diagnosis of Barth syndrome and what he passed. He checked off every single box. Like, anything Barth syndrome affects, he had it.
Wow. And how old was he when he passed away?
He was 18 months.
Okay.
Yeah. And his passing was very unexpected. It was very quick. And with Barth syndrome, individuals can go from looking happy, healthy, just fine one moment to unresponsive and cardiac arrest the next. And that's exactly what happened to my brother. So it was very traumatic. And then I ended up pregnant with Jalen. We did early gender results for Jalen during pregnancy. And I immediately knew that if it was a boy, I was going to get further testing to find out if he did have Barth syndrome. And that resulted in me getting an amniocentesis done. And I was, like, between 20 to 26 weeks pregnant during the amniocentesis. And the results of that did confirm that Jalen had Barth syndrome. And it was pretty devastating news. And from there, we got in touch with all the right doctors we needed to, got in touch with the right people. We ended up going to Children's Hospital, like, 2 times a month for fetal echocardiograms. And in his fetal echoes, they already had knew that Jalen's heart was not looking the best. The left side of his heart was, like, severely enlarged, even in utero. So much so that he was having a small leak in his ventricle because it wasn't able to squeeze all the way. And then February 8th at 5:37 p.m., Jalen was born. And it was very fast delivery. I was able to hold him for a brief second. He was sent to the NICU. About 8:30 the next morning, Children's Hospital came and had done a echocardiogram of Jalen's heart. And by 9 a.m. that next morning on February 9th, he was being transported to Children's Nebraska in heart failure. When we got to Children's, I was able to leave with him, thank goodness. They were starting him on everything. They had placed umbilical cord lines. They had placed IVs. They had placed PICC lines, had him on very high doses of heated high flow oxygen. they had him on highest doses of like milrinone and epinephrine you can give a baby. And those just weren't enough to sustain how sick he actually was. In the fetal echo that they did again at Children's, they noticed that his heart function was less than 20%. He was in severe heart failure. And his proBNP was over 40,000. So he was just not doing great. And then the hard conversations came and they decided they, in Jalen's best interest, to intubate him. But feared during intubation that his heart would stop and they would not be able to resuscitate him. At that point, they had given him a 40% chance of surviving. And I was also asked to sign a DNR at that point. And I remember like saying, like telling them, like, please don't take my son. Like, please do everything you can to save my son. And when he was in the operating room, what should have been a simple 15-minute intubation turned into 3 hours. My son was in the operating room for 3 hours and later found out that they had to resuscitate him twice. He came back into the room after being intubated successfully. And I remember going in there and like looking at him and I said, you know, I don't mind if I have to leave after this, but I want to see my son. And they allowed me to go in the room and give him a kiss. And I remember looking at him and he was like, just did not look good. Like you could tell that he had become unresponsive in the operating room. And I touched him and he was like cold to the touch. And that was probably one of the hardest moments. And then fast forward a couple weeks, they decided to extubate him. And that resulted in him having to be intubated due to heart failure again 2 days later. So he was intubated for a second time. And then he was still on milrinone, epinephrine, even through intubation. And that just still at that point, like he was still struggling pretty bad. His labs were all over the place. Heart function was never normal. He still had a severely enlarged heart. And so finally, one of Jalen's care team members came up to me and she said, you know, we have this opportunity to start him on allimetpertide. And at first, like being a parent, hearing like an investigational drug, you're like, whoa, like what is happening right now? So initially I chose not to start him on it at that point. And then we were facing even harder routes, and it was being transported to St. Louis and listing him 1A on the transplant list, and possibly he was too small for Berlin, so he would have to have something called a PDMAG, and the success rate of that was not realistic for me. So finally, his care team came back again and was like, look, like, this is our last and final option before he has to have a transplant. Like, there's no other options at this point. We're doing everything we can, and it's just not sustaining for how sick he is. And so at that point, we said yes to starting him on allimetpertide. And March 12th of 2024, he started it. And everything changed from there. Like, he never had to be reintubated again. His labs were slowly improving. And he just looked overall happy. He was able to drink from a bottle. He passed a swallow study with flying colors. There was no issues. And then it came time to do an echo about a little less than a month of him being on allimetpertide. And I remember his cardiologist telling me, like, if this echo looks good, I will look stupid. And I'm more than happy to look stupid because that means he's doing great. And I hope he makes me look stupid. And they did the echo, and the echo revealed that Jalen had normal cardiac function. And it was slowly, his dilated heart was slowly going back to normal size. And so fast forward to the past 6 months or so, Jalen continues to have normal cardiac function. He is eating real food. He is taking his first steps. He is standing unassisted. His heart is now normal size. So we've never had to worry about the function of his heart. And he's dealt with, you know, he has neutropenia as well as a like another side effect of what Barth syndrome is. And he's had several viruses and illnesses, and he battles them all pretty darn good. We have no complaints there. So yeah, overall, Jalen, you would never know that at 24 hours old, he was in heart failure. You would never know.
Jordan, kind of walk us through this grassroots group and what you specifically did for the team as things got closer and closer to summer of 2025, we'll say. And we'll talk about that next.
It was a lot. Like, we did a lot of advocacy work. There was, and it wasn't just one, two, three people. It was a lot of people, and not just our community, but other rare disease communities as well. Mine initially started like where I really got into advocating for everybody, including Jalen, was October of 2024. And that was when I was asked by the Barth Syndrome Foundation to attend the FDA Advisory Committee meeting regarding elamipretide. And so then that was the first time that I had met Walker in person. We went together. And I also met a lot of other members of the community too, who rallied together and spoke their testimonies during the FDA meeting. So that was my first big like leap into it. And that was when we got our first positive reassurance that elamipretide would be approved. We got a 10-6 advisory committee vote in favor of a full approval of elamipretide during that meeting. And that was by the own FDA's advisory committee that they had chose. So that was like the first big thing that I had did. And oh gosh, it was nerve-wracking. It was scary. And then after that, we all attended Zoom meetings in between. There was never a time where one person was out of the loop or not caught up on the latest news within the FDA regarding elamipretide. There was just a lot of communication between, you know, the Barth Syndrome Foundation, Stealth Biotherapeutics. I have to give it to Stealth. I will say they were huge advocates for us as well. And they never gave up on us. And they did a lot of sacrificing on their behalf to be able to get where we are today. They fired 30% of their work staff just to keep elamipretide available. They invested millions of dollars without receiving any credit back. It's very nice to have a pharmaceutical company who understands the need of this medication and truly believes that something that they have in their hands actually works and is willing to advocate so hard for it. So I do have to give it out to Stealth. And then after that, kind of fast forward a little bit, we were hoping to get our final answer in the end of January. Oh, I think it was the end of January. And that did not come. They delayed it another 6 months after that. And then I think it was April. April came around. And so we were still waiting on an answer. We had no answer, no reason why we didn't have an answer. The FDA gave us nothing, pretty much. Like, we had nothing to go off of. And so fast forward to April, we were still doing a lot of advocacy work, posting on social media, visiting, you know, members of Congress. Walker and I both went to, I don't know if Walker went this time, but I did go to Rare Disease Week in D.C., and there I spoke to members of Congress and senators, and Mike Flood, on behalf of me and Jalen, actually did write a letter to the FDA. And he actually wrote a couple of them stating that, you know, he had a brave young boy living in his state and his progress is pretty remarkable meeting him, and he would like to see this approved. The NDA was already under a priority review voucher, and we were going on 15 months when usually it takes 6. And so he did mention that in his letter and that, you know, he would like to see this approved. And it is, time is of the essence in this matter. And this needs to be at the very most, utmost importance on their list. And so that was nice to have, you know, members of Congress on our side willing to go these extra steps. And that's members in all state. We had tons of people meeting with every member of the state. Like, no stone was left unturned during Murder Disease Week. I'll say that. And then fast forward to April, we got the denial, our first denial. And it was pretty devastating. I remember when we were supposed to go on the Zoom meeting that I was sitting in my car and Jalen was right behind me. And I knew, prayed and hoped and did all the things to encourage myself that, oh, this is going to be great news. Like, don't lose hope, Jordan. And then the denial came and we found out that they denied it for the first time. And I remember getting off that Zoom meeting, and I'm sure a lot of other members in our community can relate, feeling really defeated. Like, what did we miss? What more can we do? And I remember just crying, holding my son and crying, thinking like, this is it. Like, there's not going to be Ellen Pepperdine. And if there's no Ellen Pepperdine, there's no Jalen. And I remember thinking that, and then pulled myself together and had to tell myself, like, your advocacy does not stop here. You know, you have other people who rely on you just as much as you rely on them. Jalen relies on you. You know, if my brother was here, I would have done the same exact thing. My brother, my peace for my brother is getting something that he could have taken that could have saved him to save my son. And that was just what replayed in my mind over and over and over again for me not to like feel defeated and give up. So the advocacy still continued. We were still sending emails to members of Congress. We were still, at that point, we were emailing the FDA, writing handwritten letters to the FDA, like, you need to reconsider. We were having meetings with Stealth on what their plans were going forward. We pulled out all the stops. We did not give up. So that was like in April and then going forward. And then August came. And then Stealth did ask the FDA to formally reconsider at that point. And in August, we found out that the FDA said no. They were not willing to reconsider their decision. So it was pretty much another denial. Like, in this case, you don't have enough people to fit in the box that the FDA is trying to put you in for a rare disease community, and you will never have enough. And that was the big thing that we wanted to express to them. Patient testimonies during our ADCOM meeting and letters and emails and everything else that had been sent in are just as much proof as data is. You can't tell, like Walker, for instance, you can't tell Walker what he is feeling is what they like to call placebo effect. You would never know. And that was like the big thing that they all said. Oh, what if it's placebo effect? You know, and my big thing with experiencing how well Jalen and a couple other, you know, infants that I had met, a baby can't will their own heart. They can't will themselves to feel better. And if nothing else is working and Ellen Pepperdine was the only thing that changed, what is the common denominator here? I specifically remember a Stealth employee specifically telling us, we have funding for August, but September is unknown.
Wow.
We do not know if you guys will have access to this come September. And we're already in like the beginning, middle of August. And we're like, holy cow. Like, at this point, yeah, at this point, what options do we have left? So that's when this last advocacy point was our, and along the way, mind you, Madison is doing phenomenal with social media. She rallied a ton on social media. Everybody is posting on social media, and we're using hashtags that were told to us to use, tagging.
She formed a site, right? Madison, tell us about
it. She did.
Like, we came into the fray with the denial in May. So like, we were just kind of like trying to adjust to being back at home after being in the hospital. And I had like seen like Barth syndrome stuff on Facebook here and there, but like really hadn't gotten involved. And then we saw that there was a denial, and I Googled it. And I watched Jordan's interview. So Jordan did an interview with her local news station, and I watched it. And in the interview, she says, like, if we don't get this, you know, the company is saying you only have six to nine months of runway left. And that was the first I had heard of that. So like, thank God for Jordan and Walker and everyone for many reasons, because like, number one, Jordan even being willing to try Elmebrutide with Jalen was one of the reasons like we were willing to do it, because our cardiologist said, like, you know, he's not the first one. There have been other babies who have taken this and done okay. And that gave us peace of mind. Like, okay, well, like, I guess we'll do it too. Like, you know, so it's like everything always builds on everything. So yeah, I saw Jordan's interview, and that's when I like realized like she was the number that my cardiologist had given me to reach out to when we were in the hospital. She said, here's the phone number of another mom who her child has Barth syndrome, if you want to connect with her. And so I called Jordan, and because we were like, what do? We need to do media. So we had started reaching out to our local news stations. I called Jordan to figure out like, what do you even say? Like, we were super nervous. I was like, I don't want to put my kid on the internet. Like, I don't even know how to use Instagram. Like, I'm scared to go on TV because like, you know, what's going to happen? And so like, I got a chance to talk with Jordan, and she just like reassured me, and all that. I'll never forget, girl. You were like, I was like, what do I say if they ask you about the FDA? And she's like, say, why don't you ask Marty McCary what's going on? Just like, I just remember I was like, who is Marty McCary? Like, I had no idea what was going on.
You learned a lot fast.
So like, I was like, I guess we're building a plane while flying it, because we were new to the game, really. Like, we were just like, what is the FDA? And so, we did a news interview here, and then we got connected with Shelly and with everybody else. And so then the Zoom meetings Jordan was talking about that had been going on for a while, we started going to those Zoom meetings. It was a very coordinated response to the rejection or the denial, the CRL, because, you know, there were hundreds of congressional meetings, and it was basically like, here's what you do. Reach out to this person. Here's the health staffer. Here's who you email. If you're in this district, like, you know, fill like, these are the people you reach out to. And then we did like, here's a link that can auto-generate an email and send that to everyone you know and post about it. And like Jordan said, here's the hashtags we're using. So the response, you know, I remember the Zoom meeting we were in where it was like, here's the hashtags we're using. These are the things we should be doing. Everybody like go. And so that's what we did. We just did what was suggested. And then through that, through the algorithm, like the way Instagram works, I started seeing posts about Elmebrutide from other people. So I met another family in Georgia who their daughter, Hope, is on Elmebrutide, and she does not have Barth syndrome. She has a different mitochondrial condition. And so she was on it through expanded access. So I connected with them. We started coordinating some of our advocacy. We started like a silly podcast that we like interviewed everyone we could think of with, you know, who would want to talk to us about Elmebrutide. And so it started to just be like, yeah, it's all day, every day. I was like, what am I going to post? Who am I going to tag? Who am I going to follow? And just like trying to generate enough, you know, views in the algorithm. So, you know, I've always liked making videos, and I've always liked web design. So like, that part wasn't work to me, but it was the uncomfortable part about it was like, okay, I'm going to have to like put my kid on the internet. But it was like, well, I want people to see his face because I want people to care about this. It's like, you're trying to think of like,
yeah,
how do I want people to feel? And what do I want people to think when they are interacting with this word, Elmebrutide? And what do I want people to feel when they hear Barth syndrome? So we just thought about that. And so I, you know, made videos of Gilbert and made, you know, you put music to it. And it's very like, I'm just trying to think of how to communicate to everybody else here's my child. I love my child. I will do anything for them. Here's why this is important. And then you just...
It's not about the drug. It's about saving your child.
Yes. I'm trying to save my child and every other kid and person who's on this. And so that's what we did. I mean, all of our advocacy, sometimes it feels really surreal because it all happened like this on a screen. Like every meeting I did with every person in Congress was on Zoom. Every post I made was on my phone. Like all my advocacy, I can just put my phone down and it's not there. But if I pick my phone up, you know, and I get on Instagram, that's where it all is. So it was very surreal because it was all virtual for me. But yeah, but you know,
can make so much more progress. You can hit so many more people and create more awareness online for sure.
See, and I will say too, along with social media, the outreach was insane. It came to like points where people were posting on their Instagram stories and Commissioner McCary was looking at them from being tagged, and then RFK was looking at them from being tagged several times in Instagram stories. So I will say like social media is another huge form of advocacy because social media is huge. You could post something today and it have 50,000 likes or shares by tomorrow. Like it is just insane. And so that's what we did. We made certain hashtags. That way, if anybody looked up the hashtag Eloniprotide, every single post would pull up on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all of it.
I've never seen a group of people more motivated and determined to get something done in my life. I mean, it's amazing. And like one thing the commissioner told us, and Jordan can probably tell you exactly what he said, but he said something on the lines of, you know, if I was going through something like this, I would want to fight with a group of people like you guys.
His specific words to us, and there was about 7 of us affected families or individuals in the room. His specific words were, if I had a rare condition, you guys would be the one advocating for me because you're a force to be reckoned with.
What a compliment.
And that will forever like be stuck in my brain because it's just knowing that your advocacy, one, doesn't go unnoticed, and two, goes far beyond what you think it's going. When you're doing advocacy in a situation like we were in, you feel so helpless. And I'm sure that's how everybody felt. Like, what we're doing is not enough. What more can we do? When I say towards the end, I'm sure we were all feeling so helpless, defeated, like we weren't doing enough. That is what initially started the last leg of our advocacy work. And believe me when I say it's not our last leg forever, because this fight's not over. It's definitely not over. And we are just beginning on all the further we can go. There's still, you know, other communities that have treatments that need approved, and we are fighting right alongside them. We are advocating for them just as much as they did us. Eloniprotide is not in the approval phase right now that we would 100% be okay with.
Okay.
We have the approval, yes, but we're not 100% at comfortability right now, speaking from my point of view, because the approval is not for individuals like my son. We are only being told that Gilbert, Jalen won't come off of it because they were already on expanded use before the approval. They've already been taking it for so long, so they wouldn't pull them off. So they'll remain on the EAP through the stealth.
So Madison, walk us through this last leg before the approval took place.
Well, like Jordan was saying, the weird thing about everything was like, when you look back at it and it's like, it's already happened, you can see like a timeline, but when you're living it and when you're going through it is literally everyday survival. It's like, what's going to happen today? I don't know. Am I going to wake up and I'm going to get this news? Am I going to get that news? So literally every day was just you're just in fight mode all the time. I was going to say fight or flight, but there's no flight. You're just
fighting. There's no flight. Fight or flight.
Yeah. So in July, self-requested a reconsideration after, you know, they had met with the FDA and the FDA encouraged them to do that. And then we got that denial at the beginning of August. And that's like when Jordan was saying, that's when it got really, really scary, because it was no longer like we have 6 to 9 months left, 6 to 9 months left of runway. It was, we don't know if we have any more in September. Like, we don't know if you will have, if we as a company will be operating, which means you will not have access to drug anymore. So Andy and I, my husband, we went to the fridge and we counted how many vials we had in the fridge. And that was probably like one of the scariest moments of my life, because that was, apart from like Gilbert's initial hospital stays and everything, it was like, so this is the number of days potentially left of stability for my child. And then we had a conversation with this cardiologist of like, well, what happened? And it was like, we don't know, because he's never not been on this. And when he wasn't on this, he was in severe heart failure. So we went back, we did another round of media. We did another round of congressional outreach. We had a meeting as a community. Like, that's what my husband and I personally did. And then we, the Barr syndrome community, had another meeting and kind of talking about like some next steps. And then there was a group that was like, well, maybe we go to DC. And I thought about taking him, but we were like, I don't know, he's still kind of little and this, that. But luckily there was a group that did go, and you have two of them right here. So Jordan and Walker both led, so they can speak to what happened in DC. The part that I played in that was, we did kind of a coinciding, what we call the L-Nipritide Action Week, while they were in DC. So we did like some online posting stuff to kind of go with their advocacy while they were out in DC. So like, you know, wear brew for Barth on this day, and, you know, tag a person on Tuesday. So we did kind of some online advocacy, just because I was like, well, I can't be there. I want to be able to do something. But Jordan and Walker,
it all counts, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but they went.
They also did something called, they made a challenge, and it was actually very, very clever. So if you don't know, L-Mipritide is a daily shot. And so they made a challenge called the Shot for Shot Challenge. And it was like, say, she did it for Gilbert, and it was like, does Gilbert deserves a shot at life? Or so-and-so deserves a shot at life. And I know Madison, when she did it, she had her daughters make up like a concoction for her to drink. And so she took the shot and she made a video, and she, you know, did the shot for shot challenge hashtag and tagged like the next person she wanted to nominate to do it. And so that was circling around like really big on like Facebook, Instagram. I think I seen a couple on like TikTok. So that was also really big too.
And I remember that interview that you did, Madison, like right after we found out, it was with your local TV station. And, you know, it was very emotional, but you were just expressing what everybody else was feeling too, you know, because we were just so hopeless at that point. You know, like I said, you know, that was one of only two times I truly was scared that this could come to an end.
So, Walker, when you were in D.C., mm-hmm. who did you meet with?
So, we met with the commission.
Like, Congress members or, like, community?
So, we went up there as a community. There was, how many of us that went, Jordan?
I think there was, like, 17 to 20 okay. of us.
So, our original plan was just to, you know, we went up there to draw attention, you know, protest, but it was peaceful and all that. And we, while we were there, we were able to get a few meetings with congressmen. But the big meeting we got was with the commissioner that Friday afternoon of the week that we were there. And kind of leading up to that, we were just hoping and kind of how we got that meeting. Many months ago, a small group of us wrote letters to the commissioner requesting a meeting. And one of the ladies that wrote the letter, hers was Pitts. So we got word of that the week before we left. And they they emailed all of us and called us and was like, hey, we got this meeting, you know, would you like to attend if it happens? I mean, we weren't sure.
You had to fill out a very tedious application to even be considered.
Yeah. And when we got word that they like accepted or whatever, we only had like 24 hours to turn it around. So they got that done. And basically they were like, okay, you know, we'll get back to you if we decide to meet with you. And then the middle of the week, we got an email saying that our meeting was accepted. And it was going to be for Friday afternoon, the week we were there. There was a group of us, a small group of us that met with him and we just shared our stories and they were just, their mind was just blown of how this drug has, you know, changed all of our lives in so many different ways. And, you know, for the babies, it literally saved it, you know, and for me, you know, it gave me a life that I could only dream about, you know, as I told them before, you know, I'm doing things, you know, I've never done before, I'm living the life I could only dream about. So,
you know, I did want to add a couple things onto like what Walker was saying about our like peaceful protest and things like that. We actually got the acceptance for our application that our meeting had been granted as we were standing outside of the White House with posters of our children. And it was like, I remember, so.
That's so emotional.
When we were standing outside the White House, it was August 22nd. And that is also my brother's birthday.
Oh my gosh.
So not only did we go protest and do all the things on my brother's birthday for the same condition he passed from, but we also got an acceptance on my brother's birthday to get an in-person meeting.
Okay, so it was that day that you got the acceptance for the meeting. Yes. So then the meeting happens, and then how long did you wait to know how that went?
So the meeting happened, and I will say, when we were in this meeting, Commissioner McCary is very, very, makes you feel very heard, very seen, and validated in everything that you're going through. He not once turned away and looked away from us while we were saying our stories. He was looking at every single one of us, and you could just tell that us telling our stories to him was like a punch to the gut in a sense. Like, this has been going on for so long and you guys don't have a treatment is kind of what his face looks like. And after receiving so many pushback dates and delays and refused to reconsiders, and we all expressed this and we all expressed to him too, not just our community, but even the more broad rare community, they will never fit in a box that you guys are trying to put us in. It will never work. You guys are asking for way too many patients for trials. We don't have that many. How can we give you that many if there's not even that many to begin with? And so we expressed that to him. And it was like he was acknowledging everything we said. So I will say that our meeting with him, every single one of us left super emotional because it was a big moment. But emotional too, because for the first time in a long time, you actually feel like you're seen in a rare disease community. And so I know during our meeting, he said, I have my top two scientists on this review. I'm done messing around. Like, top two scientists, I've assigned them to this review. I personally can't do it, but they will do it. So the top two scientists at the FDA were on the review. And he said, have your sights set for late September. September 26th, 2025, we were supposed to receive our answer.
Okay.
Then meet every member that attended this meeting with Commissioner McCary had received an email. And it said, on this day, at this time, join this meeting. Everyone that was there needs to attend. This is really important. And they wouldn't give many other details other than... that was September.
The week before we were supposed to find out.
Okay. That was September 19th.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so September 19th, we got all, everybody that attended the meeting with Commissioner McCary, all got on this Zoom meeting. And lo and behold, who attended this meeting was Commissioner McCary's chief of staff. And he was on there. And mind you, our meeting, we were supposed to have it that afternoon, and it had gotten delayed till that evening.
Okay.
So in between, like, there's no news, no nothing, no press release. We had no clue what we were walking into, whether it was going to be an acceptance, a denial, a delay. We had no clue. And so we all got in the meeting, and the best day of our life happened, and that was Commissioner McCary's chief of staff telling us that he wanted to be the first to formally congratulate us on, before it had hit the wire, on an approval for Elimipritide.
Oh my gosh.
And I just remember like turning my camera off and crying because my son was sitting next to me. And I just looked at my son and I knew that he had more life ahead of him.
Yeah.
Because like Madison said, we had all the hard conversations about what his life would look like if he stopped Elimipritide. And none of them were easy. They pretty much told us he would most likely go back into heart failure. You would be back in the place you begged to escape at one point, and it just won't be good. And so when we finally got that approval, when we finally heard approval, it was, I think a lot of us were so shocked, all we could say was thank you. And it didn't like hit us all the way until like a couple days later. And I remember talking to Walker and I'm like, holy cow. Like, this isn't exactly what we wanted, but this is a start. Like, this is huge.
Yeah. I think we all were just in shock. You know, it's like, it's going to be okay.
And then conversations didn't stop there. We had, after the approval, conversation with Stealth themselves, and they wanted to congratulate us for, you know, Stealth did say would not be possible without this community who just does not give up. They are not willing to give up. And like I said, it's not just us, but Stealth themselves, they were not willing to give up.
Wow.
And I commend them so much for that, because it is not often that you get a company who is dang near bankrupt and firing 30% of their work staff and barely making ends meet and like trying to figure out whatever way they can to continue this. It is not often, and it is very rare, that you find a small pharmaceutical company willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And they did. And I will be forever grateful for them.
Walker, how did it feel that day when you found this out?
Yeah, I think.
Did you handle it yourself? Did you tell everyone you knew?
No, I told everyone I knew. I think the biggest thing was just the stress off our shoulders was gone. You know, the work we've been doing for so long, it finally was going to be okay. We finally reached the goal that we all have been working so hard for. And I mean, like Jordan said, I mean, if it wasn't for Stealth and so many others, you know, we would not be here today. And just knowing now that we broke so many barriers. I mean, we literally made the impossible possible. And we I don't know, there's only, 3 or 4% of rare diseases that have, you know, cure or treatments, and we're, you know, we're one of those. And, you know, it's unbelievable. I mean, all of us will be forever grateful for everything that everyone has done. And, you know, now that this has happened, we think this could help so many others. Like, if you ask, you know, Stealth, if you ask me, if you ask Dr. Verne, if you've asked, you know, some people that have been doing this a little while, we all say that we have just hit the tip of the iceberg of what this drug could do for so many others. You know, with Barr syndrome, without Barr syndrome, I just saw an article press release from Stealth, and they're starting to do another study on another disease using glampatide. And so, you know, we'll see how that goes. And just, it's incredible.
Well, you guys are incredible. I am so impressed with the work that each of you are doing. I can only hope that there are more treatments down the road in the mitochondrial disease world, and we can look to you for advice on how to find the same success, you know, and we can all be partners in this, and we can be a bigger crew, you know, if we all stick together. I am so unbelievably proud of you guys, and I just really hope for semi-smooth sailing, I'll keep saying, you know, as things move forward for Walker and Jordan and Madison, for your boys. And I think, you know, both Madison and Jordan, your brothers, would be so proud of you. I think that is important to say. Thank you all so much for your energy and your time and telling us how all of this went. I commend you and I thank you, and I hope to hear more from you. So, you know, as things continue to move forward, we will make sure to stay in touch.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.